so far, and then you become uncommercial, and then you become uncommercial.
Whole bloody thousands and thousands upon thousands of them have stood and pretended to enjoy something they didn't understand.
I don't think there's any art.
Segue, the carefully planned upcut, the well-done overlay. When you're putting several records together in a row, you may find a place where you'd like to drop in just one verse out of another song. And knowing how to fade that pot up just at the right time, knowing how not to fade it too fast, knowing when to dump a record, these things need to become second nature to a good progressive rock disc jockey.
I have my tape recorders. I have two tape recorders, and in my spare time, I record my records.
When I play my records now on tape, you know, I don't write just what it's playing, but it gives me food for thoughts.
I see.
And recollect, and put it the comical way I saw it.
Yeah.
It's all nothing but bits and memories of things that knocked me out.
First person you can remember seeing sit with a guitar and sing the blues.
The first song I ever played, my father used to play that. Make it sound like a one-man band.
How long you been playing
records? Well, like all my life, since I was 12. Sit down and play it. That's when I didn't have a good time. Just sit down on the log and play all to myself. Make the sound, it sound good. I just play and cry. Tears coming up.
That was real homemade music then.
Real homemade music. Style is back here. Easy, easy, easy.
There are a number of different scratches. You got the laser, then you got the scribble, the crab, what they call the chirp.
Laser, scribble, chirp, what does it mean?
Let's play the message.
Laser, laser, chirp, scribble.
What were those last three sounds?
That's what they call a stab.
Play it again.
Stab, stab, stab.
I think this was more than a message. It was a threat.
Disco.
DJ and often I would stop out just about that one day.
I used to be a DJ and I never did.
Really?
Yeah.
I was too nervous. I used to make every song play for about 2.5 minutes because I was scared of...
Right.
That's how I just like, you'd get about a verse and chorus of each song. Yeah. I used to get through about 90 records an hour.
What, worried people get bored with your choice?
No, I just worried that it would fade out or something.
Okay, right.
Today's interview on the Ink Studs at CITR 101.9 FM is going to be with Eric San, a.k.a. Kid Koala, where we will discuss his book, Nymphonia Must Fall, as well as comics and more fun stuff. So check it out.
To see their faces when they try to stop this baby.
Have a 10:15 curfew here.
So what?
Well, you're playing your record player. It's well after 10:15. What would happen if everyone stayed up after 10:15 playing the record player?
They would love it. They would love it. They would love it.
Hi, Eric?
Yeah.
It's Robin from the Inkstuds. How you doing?
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. So you ready to chat about comics?
Sure.
Or about your comics? It's, I guess, a little different interview for you.
Yeah.
Well, to give you a little background on who I am, where I'm coming from, out of UBC, and you probably know what that is. You're from Vancouver at one point, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's a radio show all about independent and alternative comics, and I thought it'd be great to talk to you about comics because you got the new Phonia Must Fall, and all your CDs come with comics.
Right.
So, I guess, how are you doing today? I'll start out with.
Exactly.
Pardon?
Pretty good.
Good. Good. Adjustment.
Just, you know, doing my last minute crash set put together.
You're about to go in a little
bit before hitting the road, yeah.
You're going to be in town, I guess, on Saturday.
Yeah.
At the, right. The Commodore. Okay.
The day when there's just records all over the place.
I remember DJing as a younger man and the piles of crap everywhere, trying to figure out what's going to be good and
yeah.
What won't. But I really want to bring it.
Yeah.
I'll start out. What got you into doing comics as a part of your output of stuff?
I think it was kind of a natural way for me to think about making records, actually, because my very first record experiences were always storybook records. I was about, you know, two or three. My mom would buy me these storybook records that just, I don't know. This was before the time of television in my house, at least.
I think I had this one of the Star Wars ones where R2-D2 would beep to turn
right.
a page, like that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So my very earliest record memories always had a companion read-along book or illustrated segment to it. So when it came time for me to do my first album with Ninja, it was just one of those things. While I was recording it, I was imagining all these things that you could look at the same time.
So they're supposed to complement each other?
A little bit, yeah. Some projects more than others. For the albums, it's kind of a concurrent thing. So while I'm in the studio recording, whenever I need a break from that, I would go to the drafting table to draw a bit, just because scratching all day every day is kind of unhealthy.
It's a, I
so
guess it's
for
a,
me it was a sense of balance. You know?
It's probably a good exercise on the hands for kind of changing positions and stuff.
Exactly. And it's great because you just sort of when you come back to the recording studio, you have more perspective on everything too. On projects like Newphonian and this new Mosquito book, it's actually the story and the visual aspect of it that's being created first, and then the music is sort of acting like a sound score or soundtrack
mm-hmm.
to certain scenes in the book. So on those projects, you can see a more definite correlation. This musical piece was designed to underscore this scene in the book, what have you, you know.
Like with Nephonia, its page is set out with certain tracks.
Exactly.
Now, are
that
you
was sort of the panel I was imagining in my mind when I was writing the piece and putting it together.
Is it kind of the idea that someone would listen to the album while reading the comic, so it like kind of, or would it be too spread out, I guess? Because it's a big book.
Yeah, some people say that the album's actually too short compared to the book, which I think was 350 pages or something.
Yeah.
I think they got maybe two or three chapters into it, and then they'd have to put the record on again. I don't really mind. People have whatever they have time for, you know, that's fine with me. Personally, I think it's a great thing to just sort of have running while you're reading through it the first time. But, yeah, no, by no means do you have to hit pause and wait for the certain...
For the beep.
And then, you know, for it to make any sense. I think it's all just... Overall, it was just a zone that I was in when I was doing all of it.
Well, they both kind of have that same feeling, like the music and the book. They're both, like, really subdued. Like, the music's kind of, like, muted, which kind of goes with the gray toning of the comic too.
Yeah, and I blame the weather for that primarily. Most of it was done, it was done over 3 years, but I remember the story actually being written during the winter time, and then the music was done in the winter time 2 years later also. I was in an apartment with maybe, there was three or four people living there at the time, and so all my musical output for Newphonia had to happen, usually happens in the evening, after midnight till 4 a.m. So the thing with that record was, just by default, because there were other people living in the house, I had to do this very kind of quiet record in the corner of the house.
And kills
mostly
your
on headphones and just a little piano and one microphone, but it wasn't really about cranking it up and waking everybody up. So it just has that feeling,
Well,
but it made sense because Newphonia again was when I was penciling and inking and all that stuff. It all seemed to happen during the winters.
Well, and it's just it's kind of goes with that whole isolation in Newphonia of the character that he goes through and stuff. So that kind of makes complete sense.
Yeah.
You get out there and do your stretcher stuff. I didn't spend all that money on turntables for nothing. I believe in you. You gotta believe in yourself.
I don't know, Moms.
Now, Newphonia, you said you worked over 3 years. When did you first have the idea of doing an epic book? Because, for a comic artist, it's a big book. For, a musician going and just doing a comic, I mean, that's, extra baggage. You know what I'm saying?
It was it's a funny thing. I think for me, all those crafts are kind of related to me. Animation, comic art, or getting into writing graphic novels, and also making recordings out of snippets of vinyl and piecing them all together. That's all kind of a tedious process. You have to sort of enjoy that meditative quality of it all, I guess. For me, it was actually just kind of a new opportunity to try something else. I had done the book with Carpal Tunnel Syndrome, which had been released, I think, in 2000. And it was, oddly enough, this, I believe it was a CBC News item, where somebody had come over and interviewed me. Just did a little story about carpal tunnel syndrome and this whole tour that we were doing around it, and had filmed a little snippet, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 seconds, flipping through the liner notes, which was this comic book. And this gentleman named Robert Lecker, who was watching the news that night and was also in charge of this the Montreal leg of this publisher called ECW Press, had been watching the news and all of a sudden had this idea to maybe, propose something. So it was between him and this lady who was their kind of acquisitions person, Emma McKay, who was actually familiar with my music as well. They pretty much just invited me to lunch. And it was awkward because I didn't know what we were going to talk about. And they basically offered me a sort of startup contract, I guess, to do a book for ECW, and the stipulations in the contract were 10,000 word minimum, 100-page minimum on any topic.
So he'd never worked with comics before.
No, exactly. And so I said, okay, right, but yeah, I didn't really think I was, and I still don't think I'm really an authority enough on anything to write 10,000 words on anything. So for me, it was kind of, you know, but I thought about it, I was like, hey, you know, that sounds kind of like a fun little challenge. And what happened was, originally I thought they would want like a technical book about, you know, engineering of, or the craft of scratching or something, you know, mm-hmm. kind of boring. And no, they said basically, no, any topic you want. So, oddly enough, I'd been doing a lot of touring for Carpool. I think we did, you know, 200 cities or something following the release of that record. And so that whole idea of just, like, being in a city for, you know, in your own kind of reality.
Your own bubble.
Flying through all these different places. That was a lot of downtime to, yeah, write a story about anything, really. So when I started, it was about this idea of this place called Newphonia, this place where people would have no fun all the time. And it was about this sort of crazy dictator who would just make everybody listen to one song for the rest of eternity, and how horrible that might be.
It'd probably be like Chicago or something like that.
Yeah.
Peter Cetera.
Chicago has a lot of music. Chicago has a lot of great graphic novelists as well. But yeah, so I had this sort of loose idea about this character who would send these robots out in the world and force everybody to listen to the same song. And while I was designing this robot, this sort of army of robots, I was just going through a few different designs, and then this kind of pudgy one ended up on the sketchbook.
A little four-eyed guy.
Exactly, and he kind of just seemed a little more compelling to me, like there was more to him than just being some drag in this whole bigger story. But I had spoken to Robert about this, you know, I had this, you know, weird kind of narrative about Newphonia and talking about this title, and I said Newphonia must fall to me, and he really liked the title. Like, and that was, to me, was just, you know, an idea. It wasn't necessarily going to be the title of the book. But that, again, was in very early stages. And then as the robot story developed, it stopped being about the whole, you know,
dystopian,
yeah, exactly,
Brazil style.
It stopped being about that and completely just turned into this weird romantic tragedy about this robot that's trying to write love songs. And I kind of just went with it because it was telling me to go that way. And what ended up happening was, when it was time to submit the manuscript, a 10,000 word, 100 page manuscript, I sort of left this.
Here's some character designs and a rough
block of paper on a table. And luckily for me, they really enjoyed it, and they liked it, and they said, yeah, we want to put this out. So I kind of lucked out, even though I was in breach of, I think, every stipulation on the contract at that point.
Well, they were whining and dining you, you know, so.
Yeah, it was just one of those things that just ended up going the way it went, you know. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun to do, for sure.
Oh, well. Good luck finding a DJ who can move and shake like this.
We'll be honored if you will play jazz flute for us. I can't. Please.
Can you play jazz flute?
The devil.
Play some jazz flute! Yes! You, get on stage now.
Jazz flute has always been a small passion of mine.
The letters concerning the new process of recording and its results prompt me to venture a suggestion that at least some of the unpleasant noise described by correspondents may perhaps be due to the way in which the records are played, and not so much to the records themselves.
What are some of your influences for art? Is it because, I mean, it doesn't really seem like you use a lot of, like, graffiti and style. It seems, I don't know, a little rougher than that.
Well, I can't really draw, you know. That's why I like robots. People always ask me, I guess robots are actually kind of a cliche thing in graphic novels. I had known that.
No, they're not.
Well, I don't know. Like, I remember speaking to somebody. I was in the Midwest, and I was bringing a book around just to see if we could just drop it off at some stores and check out what the local scenes were like and what have you. And I remember one of the clerks was rolling their eyes like, oh, another book about a robot.
You know what? The unfortunate thing is comic store employees have the worst reputation for any form of tact or respect.
Right. No, I enjoy that, though. And I thought about it, and I said, well, you know, I'm actually coming at it from an outsider perspective. I come from sort of the DJ realm, which in a sense is equally sort of introverted, I think.
Yeah.
Types of people.
Well, it's still like that whole collecting
instrument, as do like someone who want to tell stories through comic art. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's pretty funny.
Well, the whole collecting aspect is such a key part to both cultures.
He's saying at some point this person just devoted like a lot of formative social years to just locking themselves in a room and either reading comic books or just listening to the records and
or both.
Learning how to, yeah, or both. So, but what I enjoyed about that was because I spend most of my time practicing playing records and scratching, so my drawing skills I'm still kind of working on. But the coolest thing about, I think, having that robot character, at least in the first book, was just people could assign whatever it was that they found compelling about that panel. That, you know, it was left up to interpretation a bit more. Whereas I think a more skilled artist might say, okay, well, there's actually 75 different muscles in the face, so if you change the angle of this eyebrow and this, you know, it means something else.
You know,
I actually never went like that deep into it. I was like, okay, here's this really flat-looking, boxy robot. And this is the situation, and, you know, here's the music, and then that's about all I can help you with.
I've done a lot of interviews with a lot of comic artists, and a lot of them, it's a rare one where I'll get one who gets really deep into, like, the mechanics of the drawing. Most of it, it's just drawing what you enjoy.
Yeah.
I find. Yeah. Like, not worrying. You
know, have fun with it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I knew I was completely off track already while I was starting to do the paneling for it. Like, well, this is not what the publisher is looking for at all, but for some reason I'm still doing it. And all of a sudden it's like 200 pages into it. Well, I might as well finish it at this point, even though they might just reject this manuscript.
You had
it got
fun.
To the point where, well, you know, if they don't like it, I guess I'll find some way to, like, put it out myself or something like that. It just turned into its own little, you know, monster. So.
And Ninja Tune co-published it, right? So.
Ninja Tune helped with the distribution.
Oh, okay.
As well as the music portion of it. They helped with the manufacture of the soundtrack, which was included with the book.
Ah.
So it was a nice, you know, collaboration between the two worlds, too, you know.
Let us take the case of the average youth before the era of the gramophone. Alone in a drawing room, he was terribly shy and self-conscious. He was restless and ill at ease and bashful. The gramophone has altered all this. It has taken impatient, yearning, but diffident youth by the hand and has led him into the paths of self-confidence, experience, and fulfillment. This much, at least, has the gramophone accomplished for the young man of today.
Thank you. Everybody has a favorite song. I have no excuses to offer.
Now, you're talking a little bit about your next book, and I read something about, like, a mosquito...
That's right.
...trying to play the trumpet or something like that.
Yep. He's trying to play the clarinet.
The clarinet, sorry.
Yeah. We've, right after Newphonia was launched, we did, I think maybe it was a 12-city tour to kind of promote that, book, and it was a sort of a seated cabaret style, so it was very, very different from my usual type of venues that I would play and things like that. And it was a kind of a quiet evening out, kind of mm-hmm. like a book reading mixed with a, I don't know.
Did you do like visuals and stuff with
it?
Yeah,
we had a slideshow, and we would do music from the soundtrack while the panel was being projected, and do a little storytelling, introduce the characters, and I was going around playing in different bookstores and DJing bookstores. It was very bizarre. But it was a really, really enjoyable time. We had so much fun doing it. I said, you know, that was a really great time. We should try it again. And that's the beginning of Mosquito. I started working... Well, at the time, I was working with Luisa Chavez, who did all the grayscale mm-hmm. in the book, and it was a very close friend.
Was that wash, like ink
yeah,
wash?
Yeah, exactly. She was the grayscaling.
Yeah.
She would do that. I think she did it on the computer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but she's a painter by trade, and we always wanted to work on something together. And so we had so much fun doing Newphonia together that we said, oh, it'd be fun to start something else. And so I went on this tour, and... I remember back from the tour, I had this whole idea about this clarinet playing Mosquito. So I started writing, you know, some basic plot lines for her. I started to tell her about it. And I went on this other tour, and I came back, and she had this box when I came back at her studio. And she said, oh, I have a present for you. And I was like, what's that? And, you know, she goes, I'll open it, right? And I opened the box, and it was this little miniature bedroom of the Mosquito's bedroom, or what she thought it looked like in the country at the beginning of the book. And I said, what is this? She goes, it's his bedroom. And she had just done that off for fun, you know,
yeah,
spare time. And so she just found a bunch of, you know, wood chips and paint and put it all together. And it was one of those things that just make you cry right when you saw it. You know? It just
the work, you know,
the
and detail
just bled out of it. So I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And we started talking about it. Like, are we actually going to do it this way? And we said, yeah, let's do it. Let's try it, you know. And that was 3 years ago. It was actually almost 4 years ago, so it got to that point where we decided to do the book in 3D.
Oh, wow.
So all the paneling, all the storyboarding has been done for a couple of years now, and the last 2 years I've been making models, and I've been sculpting all the characters, and we've been taking photos for each panel. So if you...
That's
Are you near a computer?
I'm right at a computer.
Oh, okay. If you go to the MySpace page...
Yeah.
It's, I think, myspace.com/K Vintage Koala 1s and 2s all spelled out.
Don't mind me, I'm just have to turn away. Okay, so I'm at the MySpace page. Listeners, go to the MySpace page.
Yeah, if you go to the blog section
there. Oh, there we go. Sorry about that.
No problem. The blog section.
Yeah.
I think it says, like, view all blogs at the bottom or something. Or.
Yeah, just, okay.
And then just scroll down. We put it up maybe over a year ago. So if you scroll down past all the more recent.
The tour photos and such.
Yeah, past the tour photos, past, I think there was some t-shirts or something up there.
There's some hoodies, the B-Boy videos.
Yeah, keep going.
It only goes as far as the hoodies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it in between there isn't something mosquito book?
Does not look like it.
Really?
There's a lot of staring contests and other stuff.
Hold on a second. Let me try to see if it's up there. If I can find a link for you. Be good. At any rate, so point being that book has been in the works for a while, and so we're gonna finish it at the end of this tour in August. Pretty much blocked off the whole autumn to finish shooting the rest of it. Right now there's only one chapter shot, so there's another 12 to do.
I'm trying to think of anything I've seen like that, and I can't. Like, I know artists that have done stuff where they've created 3D images to work out the story of, like, this one comic, Cerebus. I don't know if you heard of it.
Right, yeah.
There's this one where drunk Cerebus, is going through the town, and the guy who does the background, Gerhard, actually made a 3D model of the town to get all the camera angles of how it would look from where he's standing.
Wow.
And stuff. And that's the closest I can think.
That's pretty thorough.
That he's insanely thorough. I mean, the writer is literally insane, and Gerhard is, like, meticulously detailed.
Right.
And just genius. It's good stuff.
There's a lot of laughing in our studio. Like, sometimes my friend Paul Labonte would be over to shoot some of the stuff. And I would set up the scene and have everything, you know, perfect. And it would be sort of, you know, maybe 20 minutes or half an hour to set up the actual panel. And then he'd come in and shoot it. But then the phone would ring and he'd bump the table and everything would fall over. It happened a couple of times where he's like, all right, well, see another half hour. Yeah. But
so it's kind of like claymation, I guess, without the animation.
Exactly.
But almost, it's like, there we go.
Four persons, Wallace and Gromit or something.
There we go.
Not
a bad thing to compare to.
I think their work is also very beautiful. Just a lot of fun to it, too, you know. I think. So, we were having a good time working on it, but it is pretty much the most monstrous thing that we've decided. But since we started already, we're kind of past the point of no return.
He set up a metronome at 120 beats a minute. The beat man's heat and the salivary glands of the dog water. Then Pavlov put up a second metronome, 60 beats. He never placed food with it. The dog knew that beat meant no food. At the same time, and every dog went insane. Want me to tell you something shocking? As a musician, that two-beat pattern is in every rock and roll number. It is the old boogie-woogie beat superimposed by the rumba and samba beat. And the two beats can hypnotize a young man or woman within 29 minutes so that they can get them to do anything.
Yeah. Sounds.
Well, that'd be awesome if you can send me a link to post it on the website just to give people an idea. Inkstud. If you can send it to just at inkstuds@inkstuds.com, okay, is the easiest way to find me. I'll ask a couple more questions, because one big part of your visuals is the videos, mm-hmm, and the cartoons. What kind of role do you play in developing that?
I play, actually, for the videos, I just play the audio role.
Just that?
Yeah. I really trust those directors, and I really like their work, so I pretty much let them do what they have to do, and I try to find some way to finance it somehow. Monk Myth is, I think, the first time we worked together was on Fender Bender,
mm-hmm,
and that track was actually kind of an audio radio play about this traffic altercation. I used to live on Saint-Denis Street in Montreal, and it was kind of a busy restaurant, boutique street, what have you. And so there's always people fighting over parking spaces and near misses and all kinds of angry people yelling at each other all the time over parking spaces. It's quite amusing.
It's the Montreal temper's flair.
Exactly. So I made this track about that, and so Fender Bender was really just sort of an audio score to that. And when I played it for Kenneth Monkmas, he actually envisioned all this other stuff in his head, and he just kind of drew the storyboard out for me, and I said, that sounds really weird but awesome at the same time. So he went to work on it, and yeah, that's what we had. The Fender Bender was the end product of that. For Basin Street Blues, it was actually quite, it was, I guess, a little bit more involved. I knew I wanted Monkmas to work on it again. And
they're both going for, like, that New Orleans flavor in them, right?
Exactly. I'd been to New Orleans, well, it's kind of a musical mecca for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I was down there for a week, and I had been going to see all these jazz ensembles perform in all these really dusted little clubs, and I had heard, I think, over the course of the week, every band do a version of Basin Street Blues. So when I got back on the plane to come home, it just seemed like that was the theme to the week. And I promised myself, you know, I'm going to do a version of Basin Street Blues. I'm going to do it all off turntables, you know, and, you know, just arrange all the horns through turntables and bend all the notes out off the record. And so I mentioned that to Kenneth. I said, oh, I'm going to open the new album with a version of Basin Street Blues. And he said, oh, really? You know, I want to do a video for that. Because he's a big fan of Louis Armstrong and Thelonious Monk as well. So it was just one of those. We always had that jazz connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically started working on Basin Street Blues. As a track, it took me a long time to find all the pieces to layer into it. But I had the tempo, and I had the chord cycle, and I decided, oh, we'll start with this. And I gave him that. He came back with storyboards, and actually, while he was animating, I was actually doing the music at the same time. So it got to this point where it was just kind of collaborative, because he would have something on the screen that wouldn't have anything to underscore, and all of a sudden it would make me want to put some audio or some sort of musical element in there to help that. And I think that's why that video works on that level. I remember this one point, actually, where the people are throwing confetti off the balcony or something, and at the time there was no Foley or any kind of, you know, sound,
mm-hmm,
for that part. And I said, oh, this, you know, that's such a nice moment on the screen. It helped. There was audio component to it. And so I said, oh, you know, I kind of hear kind of like a tinkly beltry kind of sound. You know? And that's actually the only part that wasn't done off turntables, was an actual beltry. And I remember the two of us decided to go down to Steve's music store, and we went into the percussion section, which I think was which the clerk there was this sort of fully, you know, tatted out heavy metal drummer type of guy.
So he probably had like the best things to hit.
It was really funny. And so the two of us walk in there, and we go to the bell trees. We're kind of like closing our eyes and just playing all the bell trees, but only at that certain kind of slow bass industry blues tempo, trying to see, okay, does this sound like confetti coming off the actual balconies? And I'm sure that guy thought we were crazy, but we were in there for a good, you know, 20, 25 minutes playing bell trees. That's what I'm saying, you know what I mean? It's
kind
of the same thing, animation, comic arts, that sort of weird attention to detail. That scratch music has.
It's all the collaboration little bits that all come together for a cohesive whole.
Yeah.
I guess the best way of putting it. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I was really happy to be able to do this. As I said before, it's a podcast, so I'll be playing on the radio here. Is there any music in particular I should play in accompaniment? Or just tracks off release?
I guess the Newphonia stuff works, or if you have the new album, there's a piece called Mosquito Blues Version 1 at the end of Side B, which I think is only available on the CD version. But all right.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Eric.
Great.
And I think I'll try and come down to the show on Saturday and check it out.
Okay. Yeah, come say hello.
Awesome. Totally. Talk to you later.
Take care.
Bye.
You've just inspired me to hire a DJ. So thank you.
Look at these waveforms at the end of the graph. They're identical. What is the cell phone noise?
There's no mistaking that sound.
Vinyl.
That was an interview with Kid Koala, a.k.a. Eric San, and we're talking about comics, and most importantly, his graphic novel, Newphonia Must Fall, and his upcoming book, which sounds fantastic, one with Mosquito playing the clarinet. Check him out at kidkoala.com or myspace.com/kidkoala1s and 2s. This is Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver from UBC. Aw, yeah.
Is that him? Could I be right? Could that be kid? I'm looking out.
pesos to see their faces when they try to stop this baby.
Oh.
We have a 10:15 curfew here.
So what?
Well, you're playing your record player. It's well after 10:15. What would happen if everyone stayed up after 10:15 playing the record player?
They would love it. They would love it. They would love it.